have informed consent before anyone receives medical care? Well, simply because they published about vaccines, their entire Pinterest account was removed. So we'll talk more about that on the next show. I hope you enjoy this one.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. This is WGTD-FM. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW-Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Jess Sheeler, an outreach and career transition specialist at Job Corps, Steve Brown, assistant professor of education leadership at UW-Oshkosh, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Mangi. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconsert, and this is Education Matters. Today's program features Dr. Regan Gurung, who is the Ben J. and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. He is joining us on the phone from Green Bay. Before he was at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, he's done a lot of things which might come up in the discussion, but his PhD is in social and personality psychology from the University of Washington. His master's degree is also from there, and he has a bachelor's degree from Carleton College just over the border in Northfield, Minnesota. So we are here because I recently had an opportunity to listen to Dr. Gurung's presentation at Carthage College about the science behind teaching and learning, and particularly teaching and learning in the college classroom. So I thought his advice would be helpful for teachers at lots of levels, and certainly for high school students planning to go to college, as well as current college students. So I asked if I could interview him for this program. So that's why you're here. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Gurung.
You're very welcome, and thanks for the invitation.
Oh, good. So let's start with something interesting. What do you think is the biggest misconception among teachers and students about how to learn?
So I'm going to break that up into the students and teachers. I think when I talk to students, and I've talked, you know, I speak to students both in high school, in middle school. I have a middle schooler myself at home, but also obviously in college. And I would say the number one misconception is that learning is easy. And if learning is not easy, then it seems like it's the book's fault or it's the teacher's fault or something else. And I think we've got to remind ourselves that learning is actually pretty challenging. It's not impossible. There are some things that are easier to learn than others, but if it's a challenge, that's okay. And in some cases, the harder we work at something, the longer we're going to remember it and know it. So especially from a student perspective, I think at its most basic, simplistic level, I think I see this notion that learning is supposed to be easy, and if it's not easy, something is wrong. From a teacher standpoint, the biggest misconception I hear about is, and you know, there are many, and I trust we'll have time to touch on a number of different ones. But from a student teacher perspective, what I hear is that there's this belief that students actually know how to learn, and learning is actually a skill. And yes, we can sort of learn naturally, but especially when you're talking about learning new things, when you're talking about high school, when you're talking about college, there are clearly specific ways to learn or strategies that can help you learn more than others. And by the same token, there are many strategies that many students use that are actually not the best. And I think that's why I like the science of learning so much, because you basically test what are students doing, what works, what doesn't work. So, you know, at the most basic level, it's this notion that learning is easy and that people know how to do it. And neither of those are true.
Wow. Well, that gives us a lot of ground to cover in 40 minutes. If you could advise students to change one thing just one thing for starters? Maybe there's more than one thing, but about how they study, what would it be?
How about two things?
Okay, two things is good.
One would be too hard. I think the two best things that, and you know what, I'm going to get crazy and I'm going to go for three things.
Okay.
The three best things you can do are plan your studying out. You plan your studying out, test yourself repeatedly on what you want to learn, and then space out your studying. And planning and spacing may sound like the same thing. One helps the other, but I want to talk about them separately, because no matter what grade you are, whether you're in high school or whether you're in college, these are the three most fundamental elements that I can share. And here I'm talking, looking at the last 70 years, the last 40, 50, 60, 70 years of research by cognitive psychologists, by educational psychologists in education, I really think those are the three big skills that need to be practiced. So again, plan out what you need to do, space out your learning, and then repeatedly test yourself on what you're learning. Those are the key elements.
So I remember from your discussion with us at Carthage that the spacing out, I think, comes from this idea that about cramming. So
Right. Tell
us a little bit about cramming and how that works in your brain.
So let's look at cramming. If you were to look at the most common ways that students study, and this is more in college, I think the way high school and a lot of K-12 is set up, it's actually set up to have students spread things out. In college, you see teachers not maybe doing as much to help students spread things out. So there are these differences in what grade. But that said, when you look at how the average student studies or how the average person tries to learn things, they will tend to wait until the last moment. Let's say that the test coming up very soon, perhaps tomorrow, or homework is due tomorrow, and they will cram in all their studying the night before. Now, there's this good news and there's bad news. If I am taking a test tomorrow and I cram a lot today, I'll actually probably do pretty well on my test tomorrow. That's the good news. The bad news is, even though I'll do well on that test tomorrow, because I have crammed, I am not going to remember what I have crammed much past tomorrow. And this is what studies both in the lab and in the classroom show. When somebody crams a lot, they may do well if tested right away, but that material will not be remembered, will not be recalled very well, even a week later, let alone 2 weeks or four, or a month or 6 months. And when you really think about why are we going to school, it's to learn stuff for our lives. And if you really want to learn stuff that you can use for your life, if the bulk of your studying activity is cramming, well, you're really not setting yourself up for lifelong learning. And that's something, I think, one of the biggest things we need to change in terms of how we study is if we cram, we're not going to remember it as much. Now, that's why it's related to this notion of spacing.
Mm-hmm.
When you space, let's say we know there's an exam next week. It's 1 week away. Instead of waiting for a day before, what the research shows is even if you have an exam a week away, having at least two or three different studying events before that exam is the best way to go. Now, you may say, is studying every day better? Well, interestingly enough, some spacing is really important for you to keep stuff. So in some studies have actually shown that if you have an exam a week away, studying three times between now and then may even be better than studying every day, because some of that spacing really helps our mind strengthen what we're learning. So that spacing things out are really important, and that's why I mentioned planning. If you don't plan, it's tough to space, because no matter what grade you're in or whether you're in college, we all have a lot to do. We can't just focus on one class. We've got to think about all the classes we're taking, all the things that we have to do. So that's why the best way to start is by putting everything on the table. What do you have due? When do you have it due? plan out when you're going to study, and then plan out spacing in between your study episodes.
Okay, that's great advice. Likewise, so do you have some advice for teachers about the way they teach that would help facilitate long-term learning?
Absolutely. So the flip side of those same three things, right? Planning, spacing, and repeatedly testing. I think we teachers, by virtue of the control we have, by virtue of the fact that we are designing our instruction, that we are designing how we teach the class, we can provide students with the opportunity to repeatedly test themselves. We can provide students with the opportunity to space out their testing. And I think we can help students plan better. Now, let's take, I think, the repeat testing, because that's the easiest thing that teachers can do. As long as teachers are giving their students repeated opportunities to test themselves, those students are automatically going to strengthen what they're learning and what they're thinking about. So I can give you one big thing. I would say teachers, make sure that you're giving students opportunities, your students the opportunity to repeatedly test themselves. And even here, I'm going to give you two types. When we think about testing, very often in college, we use multiple choice exams. That's clearly a commonly used testing method. But what's happening with multiple choice is that we are asking the person to recognize the correct answer, right? And that's mm-hmm. useful. So, you know, one of these four answers is correct. If I know it, I can recognize the correct answer. Not bad. But even better is how you test yourself. Probably better than recognizing is what's called recall, where without any prompts, without showing you options, you have somebody try to recall what they've learned. This can be as simple as coming into class and saying, all right, yesterday we talked about such and such. Tell me all that you can remember about it. And what research shows is that just this process of having a person try and bring back what they've heard, just that process makes one strengthen what they're learning even better. So you may try to recall, right? You may have this blank sheet of paper. And again, I say paper very explicitly, much better to write stuff down on paper versus typing stuff out on the computer. You have this blank sheet of paper, try to write down all that you can remember. Even if it's a blank sheet and you're not remembering too much, that's okay, because when you then go to study, you're gonna do better than if you didn't test yourself in the first place.
Huh, that is a really interesting idea. I think I teach teachers or future teachers, and that is one of the things I encourage them to do. You always start the class by thinking about what happened before and making a connection to the previous class.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I never thought of it as testing. I just thought of it as a review, but it really is kind of testing, isn't it? Or you can set it up that way.
You know, and it is testing, and actually even in the literature now, we're moving away from the word testing, because testing sounds like a bad thing. In fact, you know, the commonly used phrase now is called retrieval practice, you know, mm-hmm. practice retrieving your information. It's still testing, but you're testing yourself. And the way I like to think about it is you're testing yourself to see if you know it. And I'd much rather test myself than have somebody else test me. You know, so, hey, take control of your learning, test yourself, see what you know. Automatically, it's going to make it easier for you to study what you don't know.
Right. And if you think of it as retrieval practice, if you use that term, then you can think of it as like a friendly dog instead of
Absolutely.
A scary test, right?
That's right.
So
that's
that might
right.
work.
Go fetch. Yeah, exactly.
Go back and fetch that information. There you go. Well, there is one great image. There was another image that you used in your discussion with us at Carthage, and that was the analogy of a pearl. So tell us mm-hmm. a little bit about how the formation of a pearl is a good analogy to teaching and learning.
Yeah, you know, I've been teaching for quite some time, and when I thought about it, I really wanted to think about what is teaching or the process of teaching and learning most similar to. And, you know, I thought about the fact that to me, learning or successful learning is something like a beautiful pearl. I mean, pearls are really beautiful, and when you think about how a pearl is formed, I realize that there are some pretty neat analogies to how learning happens. So, you know, the 30-second version of how a pearl is formed, and I know many folks have probably run into this, but let me lay it out so you can see the analogy clearer. What's really neat about pearl formation is here's this oyster going about its business, and a foreign body, normally a little grain of sand, gets stuck underneath the mantle or this layer of the oyster. And this foreign body, this piece of sand or whatever it may be, starts irritating the oyster. So the oyster, to try and deal with this irritation, starts secreting these layers that start forming around this foreign body. And eventually, those layers secreted by the oyster form the pearl. So this pearl, those beautiful pearls that we all know about that vary in luster and, you know, and style, those pearls wouldn't be formed if there wasn't some irritation. And to me, that's a big analogy for learning. So instead of the formation of a pearl, to me, the formation of learning takes place and only happens when new ideas serve as that irritation. So I think as a teacher, we've got to almost irritate our students into thinking about new things. And I say irritate because sometimes thinking about new ideas is hard work. Thinking about difficult ideas is hard work. And if left to our own devices, we don't want to do hard work. None of us want to do hard work. But when somebody foists this hard work on us, it forces us to think. So I think these new ideas serve as this irritant that our reaction to these new ideas then leads to learning, just like that irritant by the foreign body leads to the formation of a pearl. So for me, when I first thought, ooh, I don't want to be an irritant, I don't want to hassle people, I then thought, you know, I realized if we don't do some of that irritation, as it were, learning is not going to happen. And I know, you know, you may say, oh, isn't there a nicer word for irritation? Well, I think some level of discomfort is important to move us out of our comfort zones. In cognitive science, there was, for some years now, there's a phrase called desirable difficulties. And Bob Bjork at UCLA, where I spent some time, came up with this phrase that said, you know, teachers, when you instruct students, you can't have it be too easy and you can't have it be too hard. There's got to be a desirable level of difficulty. And I think that, for me, you know, nicely maps onto how pearls are formed. There's that desirable level of difficulty that irritates you into growing and learning better.
Okay, that's quite a useful analogy, I think. I want to take a moment to reintroduce. You are listening to WGTD HD FM, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of the science of teaching and learning with Dr. Regan Gurung is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You're invited to go there and stream to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So now I kind of want to get into how you know some of these things that you've talked to us about teaching and learning. There's a lot of advice about teaching and learning. So in a sort of general sense, how do you distinguish between, you know, what is just somebody's idea that's been passed down and what's the real science?
Right. And that's just an absolutely great question, because I think in this day and age, all of us are exposed to so many ideas via social media, via Facebook, via Twitter and Instagram and, you know, all these other sources. And I think we've all got to be very careful about what we read. And I think there are some nice, simple things to look for. So, for example, I mean, right now, if you were to Google research shows, if you just Google the phrase research shows, you'll get a number of hits. And you'll see a lot of media pieces on research shows this and research shows that. Research shows eating fast food is bad for learning, or, you know, or so on and so forth. I think the very first thing that we've got to look for, is it actually research or is it somebody's opinion? And I think you mentioned that in your question, but that's the most basic cutoff. Is this idea coming from somebody's reflections, from their experience, or is it an actual research study? Now, experiences and reflections are valuable starting points, mm-hmm. but for the science of learning, what you want to do is use that starting point to then conduct an actual research study. And there are two main types two or three main types of research studies. You can see some research is done where people try and describe what's going on. So how are my students learning? You know, this percent of my students reread the textbook when they're studying. This percent of my students highlight. This percent of my students actually test themselves. That's purely a descriptive kind of research study. And that's useful so we can answer the what's going on question. I think next up is research that asks the what's going on question, but also adds the what's it related to question. So for example, a related to question or a correlational study is one where you see that a student's high school grades are highly correlated to how they perform in their first college classes. You will see the extent to which a student tests themselves is highly correlated to their exam scores. Those are correlational studies where it's nicely showing us something is related to something else. The third level is experiments. And here, there are researchers who actually manipulate what the student is doing. And this is done ethically. The student is asked for permission. There are controls and all that sort of stuff. One group of students tries one study technique, and their performance is compared with another group of students trying another study technique. Those kind of research studies are the only ones that we can call experiments. It's an experiment because some technique is being compared against another technique, and that's when you can tell is one technique better than the other. Now, all these three types of things that I talked about, a descriptive type of study, a correlational kind of study, or an experiment, all three give us some sort of information on what's actually happening in the classroom. And the extent to which we can take these results and apply it depends on how well the study is done. But even here, all these three are actual research studies or types of ways of doing research, and very, very different from somebody saying, hey, you know what, I've taught for so long, I think this is a good way to do it. Now, that person may be right, but that's what we call the wisdom of experience. And the wisdom of experience is often useful and a great starting point, but it's really not the same thing as a research study being done. And I think that's why, you know, to come back to your question, when I look at all the advice out there on teaching and learning, I ask myself, is this advice coming from a research study or is it coming from opinion? And that's the most basic starting point. If it is coming from a research study, I pay it a little bit more attention. If it's coming from a correlational study, I pay it a little bit more attention than if it were coming from a descriptive study. And then finally, if it's an experiment, I pay that the most attention, because there the researchers have taken care to control for a number of different factors to truly see what's going on. So really, there's a research method, and good advice is advice that comes from research ethically and well done.
So one thing that some teachers do in their own classrooms, especially mm-hmm. in middle and high school, or you know, K through 12, basically, they maybe do what they call action research, where they sort of pose right. a question and try to describe what's going on, or maybe even they'll experiment and do one thing with one class and one thing with another. So it's sort of a small scale of what you're talking about, but what obviously that has limitations because it's the same teacher and it's a, sort of a small group of students, even if you do all of your students in a semester or something like that. So how many observations or how many students would you need, do you think, to make a valid study, or does that vary based on the question?
I think it does vary, but even before we go to actual number of students, I think there's the key here And especially when you talk about action research or what's sometimes called teacher research, the really key here is, are those teachers being intentional and systematic in their mm-hmm. modifications? You know, whenever a teacher is making an intentional, systematic modification, that's much better than somebody who goes in and says, hey, let me just try this today. It's got to be intentional. It's got to be systematic. And if it's intentional and systematic, then looking at how the students are doing in response to that is the key. So once you have intentional, systematic modifications and that they're then looking at performance, when you talk about numbers, even though there are a good rule of thumb. A good rule of thumb is 25. So most classes, even when a teacher is doing it on their own class, if you have 25 students, that's giving you something. But what's even more important is, what are you comparing it to? Are you comparing those 25 students with their own performance before the modification? Are you comparing it to a previous class of 25? Either of those things work as long as there's a good, valid comparison. So I think what I don't see enough of is the systematic, intentional modifications. When it's happening, the actual numbers and the significance from a statistical standpoint, all of that can come later. But for starters, as long as that teacher has first read up on what's been done, using that knowledge of what's been done to shape what he or she wants to do in the classroom, and then making that change intentionally and systematically, that's the key start. I think, you know, things like sample size and how many students and statistical validity, all of that can come later as long as those first few steps are being done right. I think, unfortunately, you know, not enough teachers do things systematically, and when they do make modifications, they're often not looking at a good measurement of what those modifications have yielded. So has student performance actually changed or not? It's not enough to just make a modification. You really have to have a good plan in place to see how will you measure whether or not that modification has worked out or not.
Okay. So most everyday teachers, unless they're in a graduate program, they might not really be reading sort of research journals sorts of studies, but are there any books, like if you walked into Barnes & Noble, are there any books that you recommend for parents, teachers, students that are about teaching and learning that you think are actually helpful and contain valid information?
Yeah, you know, first off, it's funny you said Barnes & Noble, because I can't think of a recent time I've actually walked into Barnes & Noble.
Right.
You know, the amount of stuff that we do online nowadays. But,
right.
I think if you were to say, okay, all this stuff sounds fascinating, there are actually a couple of books that I'd recommend for the you know, whether it's a parent or a teacher or even a student. For example, just out recently is a book titled "Understanding How We Learn," and if you know very little about memory or learning, or even about the research that I just talked about, Understanding How We Learn, A Visual Guide, is probably one of the best introductions. It came out literally in the last month. It's co-authored by two cognitive scientists and illustrated. And it's just a really, really good read, because in one spot, it just tells you a whole bunch of really good information. So one of my best bets is this Understanding How We Learn. Also along the lines, in terms of some good reading, there's a book that's called How We Learn. It's written by Benedict Carey, and How We Learn, it's a really nice overview of a lot of different learning strategies and techniques and things that work. One more that comes to mind is the nicely titled Make It Stick. And Make It Stick is also another pretty good book that literally you just pull off the shelf, and that'll give you some really great overview on what's been done on teaching and learning. So those are my, especially for somebody who wants to get a quick jump on what's going on in teaching and learning, those are three of my probably my favorite books to recommend because they are just packed with good information. They're very readable. They are not academic journals that have to follow the academic journal style. These are books written for folks to nicely understand what's been going on, for folks to get a really good picture of what's going on. So again, Make It Stick, which is The Science of Successful Learning, How We Learn by Benedict Carey, and Understanding How We Learn, three really, really good go-to books. I will also say that there are a number of good blogs out there. If you don't want to, get a book, you can go online and for free learn a lot about what's going on. I have a blog called the Pedagogical Pundit, and on the Pedagogical Pundit, I write up very readable, I think, ways descriptions of research that's going on. There's also a really neat blog by actually the same folks who wrote Understanding How We Learn. They're called the Learning Scientists, and they have a blog called Ace That Test. And right there, Ace That Test, great starting point. If you want more on the research side of things, you can read my or subscribe to Pedagogical Pundit. And both of these are on, you can get it through Twitter or you can get it through Facebook. And I like blogs because it's really catching what's going on. I just yesterday, I wrote a blog piece for Psychology Today about research. Mm-hmm. And you know, going back to your question, Karen, on how do you know what's good research, the nuances of what's good research and what's not is pretty crazy. And so if you really want a quick snapshot of how to watch out for research, read my piece titled Can You Handle the Truth? Some truths about the research. So, you know, lots of really cool resources to get information.
Okay, and for the listeners, I will find links to those books and blogs and put them in the comments on the Facebook page when I put up the information about this show. So if you're listening and you're in the car or you're doing errands or whatever, if you go to Facebook and find our WGTD Education Matters page, you'll be able to find those links in the comments. So the next thing I need to do is another reintroduction. You're listening to WGTD HDFM, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of the science of teaching and learning with Dr. Regan Gurung is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. So you're invited to listen again, or you can join in a discussion at our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page. So I have a lot more questions, and we really only have about another 10 minutes. So I wanted to ask about something that I know is often people, my students come to me saying, oh, I'm a visual learner, or I'm a kinesthetic learner, or whatever. So they've done at some point some kind of test on their learning style. So tell us about that and whether that's valid and how do we know if it's valid?
I'm glad you brought that up because this notion or discussions about learning styles or misperceptions about it, that's probably the number one misperception out there. And let me be clear about what the misperception is. So you're right. People believe that they're more auditory or kinesthetic or so on and so forth. I think the problem is when individuals think that they learn better when they receive information in their preferred learning style. I think that's the key issue. So auditory learners believe, I'm an auditory learner, I need to have it in an auditory way. Something I hear in college a lot is people say, but I'm a visual learner, lectures don't work for me. Here's the big thing for listeners to pay attention to. A lot of research has been done to test this idea. The idea, is it true that you need to be taught to match your preferred learning style? And the answer is no. And I'll say that again. The answer is no. It is one of the biggest myths in learning that we have to be taught according to our learning styles. Yes, we have preferences. We do have preferences. Some of us may like things visually. Some of us may like to listen to things more. but there's absolutely no research showing that you have to be taught in that way. In fact, what the research shows is that teachers should teach in using as many different teaching styles as possible, and that's what helps learning. The moment a person uses only one teaching style, it's harder for multiple different individuals to learn as much. And the moment you switch up teaching styles, learning tends to happen better. So big myth, if you're sitting there going, oh, you know what? I wish my teacher was more visual or more kinesthetic, then I would learn better. Nope, that's not what the research says. And that's a big myth that we should put away. And unfortunately, it is a myth that a very large percent of even teachers hold, just because the new research hasn't gotten out to enough teacher programs as yet.
It's like a zombie myth. It just does not go away. It's so interesting because I pointed out I've taught both ed psych and just sort of an intro course, and it's always in the textbooks that it's not a real thing, and they still don't believe me. It's very ingrained, I would have to say. So are there any things like that? So another somewhat related idea is the idea of multiple intelligences, which a lot of teachers have learned about. That is
right.
The idea from Howard Gardner that there are 8 or 9 different special kinds of learning, and people have either preferences or talents in, you know, those same, you know, auditory or musical or kinesthetic or art, visual or mathematical. There's 9 of them now, I believe. Is there any validity to that idea?
So there's more validity or more evidence for multiple intelligences than there is for learning styles. And to make that distinction, and you did a pretty good job of distinguishing it, but I just want to underscore that. Whenever you hear about multiple intelligences, we're normally talking about different intellectual abilities. Learning styles are actually more of individual approaches to a certain task.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's where that difference exists. So with multiple intelligences, you can definitely have these different abilities, and there is clearly much more evidence for that than for learning styles or actually matching learning styles.
Hmm. So that one isn't a myth, but maybe still under some scrutiny, right?
Well, I think the bigger question is, when you talk about what does it mean for teachers and students,
mm-hmm,
right?
Right.
Yes, some of us may be more artistic. Yes, some of us may be better at creative writing. Yes, some of us may have an inclination for math or have better mathematical abilities. What does that mean for the classroom? Well, it really depends on the topic that you're teaching, right?
Mm-hmm.
All that it means, I think, the way I interpret it is, yes, some students will be more challenged by math than other students.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, some students will be more challenged by literature than other students. But that's really the extent of what it is. And it goes back to what I started with. You know, learning always has challenges, but there are ways around it, and often practice and some basic strategies can help you.
Okay. Now, you mentioned briefly earlier on that writing on a piece of paper is better
mm-hmm.
than taking notes on a computer. And this does interest and concern me, because my son just started high school, and in his school, they all were issued a Chromebook, and most of the work is done on the Chromebook. And frankly, his handwriting isn't that great. It just wasn't a thing that he spent a lot of time learning how to do. But he types really fast. So tell
right.
us what sort of cognitive stuff is going on if you're typing versus writing on paper, and why the writing is better.
Right. So first, the research that really drew our attention to this, and as I said, like before, this is not opinion or you know, reflection. This is actual experimental research, and what now 2 studies showed, actually more than 2 now, showed is that when you have students taking notes on a computer, they don't remember or learn as well as taking notes on the same material using pen and paper, right? So that it's really important. We hear these studies have actually kept the information constant And they looked at students who are typing versus students who are writing. And it's the students who are writing who seem to learn and remember better. So what's happening at the cognitive level? Well, this what seems to be happening at a cognitive level is when you take notes on a computer, you tend to do more transcribing. You tend to write down more what's on a slide or what has been said. When you take notes on paper, you tend to do more mental work with that information. When you're listening and converting in that into something you write down on paper, somehow the process of writing it down with pen and paper makes us process what we're listening to more than when we're typing something down. That seems to be the suggestion of these studies. Mm-hmm. So basically what seems to be happening is when somebody is writing something down, they are processing the information more than if they were typing something. You know, you used the word zombie before. It's almost like when we're typing, we go into this automatic mode and don't pay as much attention. And that seems to be what's going on in these in a lot of studies. So as much as possible, I recommend students taking notes on paper. Go old school, like I like to call it, pen and paper, take it down. This doesn't mean you have to retype it in later. No, you don't have to retype it in later. You may want to modify your notes, but still taking notes on pen and paper has been shown in a number of studies to be better than typing. I mean, so much so many of us in the college level actually tell our students to not use their laptops or devices to take notes, but instead use paper and pen. And it's backed by the research. This is not I don't want you using your laptop because you're going to be on Facebook. No, this is the research actually shows that writing stuff down with pen and paper makes you learn better.
Wow. Okay, well, that is a really important piece of information for people to consider. I can't believe it, but we are actually almost out of time. So I wanted to give you a few moments to tell us you have a book that is out that might be of interest to our listeners.
Yeah, you know, I think especially if you're a teacher out there or if you know teachers, far too often when we evaluate good teaching, we tend to just look at student evaluations or student scores. And there's actually a lot to being a good teacher. And two friends and colleagues of mine, Aaron Richmond, Guy Boysen, and I, took all the evidence. And, you know, you said, what's the research and how do you look at research? Well, we sort of did your work for you. And we took all the research out there, and we put it together in a book that tells you what the evidence is for teaching. And our subtitle is Developing the Model Teacher. And we really go into, if you are interested in what does the research show about good teaching and what makes a good teacher, our evidence-based guide to college and university teaching, Developing the Model Teacher, it summarizes a lot of work for you in one shot.
Okay, and I will also put that link in the comments on the Facebook page. So if you're listening to this, you can go to WGTD Education Matters Facebook page to find these links. I can't believe our time is up. I just wanted to thank you. So our guest today on Education Matters has been Dr. Regan Gurung, who is a professor of psychology and human development at UW Green Bay. And just a little shout out, you had my niece Jenna Sconzert in your class a few years ago. In case she happens to listen to this, I wanted to make sure I mentioned that. She said that you're a fantastic teacher, and my experience just learning from you in one day, I felt that way, which is why I wanted to interview you. I think you've given us a lot of...
I appreciate it.
I appreciate you taking the time. And I think you've given us a lot to think about. So I hope all of you out there listening take a few moments to look at the recommendations for books that he made on our Facebook page. And just want to summarize, you have been listening to WGTD HD-FM on Education Matters, this discussion of the science of teaching and learning with Dr. Regan Gurung of UW Green Bay is archived at WGTD.org. On the Education Matters page. You're invited to listen again or go to our Facebook page and join in a discussion there. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Support for WGTD.